Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of the Fashion Grunge podcast. I am Lauren, and guess what? I'm solo today. So this is going to be really interesting. This is episode 177. I can't believe, God, we're almost at like 200, which is crazy because there's still so many 90s movies that I haven't done yet. But this is going to be an interesting one because, oddly enough, I'm doing Gone in 60 Seconds from 2000. And this is probably one of my, I don't want to say it's one of my favorite movies, but it's up there. So I asked, you know, my usual recording partners, you know, hey, does anyone want to do this movie? And everyone was kind of like, meh, you know, not really, but I'll do it if you want me to. And I was like, okay. So then after a while, I was like, wait a minute, I can just do this because I really love this movie a lot. And I kind of wanted to do it in a way where it wouldn't be kind of weird if someone wasn't really, really into it. And I'm really, really into it because of a lot of reasons, which I'll get into. So everything's going to be the same with the episode, same topic, same discussions, all that kind of stuff. At the top of the show, I always forget to say this, but please leave a review, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify and wherever else you can rate. It really, really helps the show a lot. I've got some interviews coming up soon, which should be interesting. Going to be on some future pods coming up. So I'll let you know when those are going to come out and all that fun stuff. But yeah, in the meantime, do all that. Leave us a review. And if it's kind of a bad review, then just email me and tell me what you want me to change. Just don't leave anything bad. We already had a 1-star review that kind of shot my blood pressure up a little bit. So I was like, okay, I need to stop taking this personally because I actually don't care that much. But I guess I probably do because I just brought it up again. But anyway, so then also we have Patreon. You know the drill. If you don't know the drill and you're listening to this for the first time, welcome. This is a great episode for you to jump in on, but go check it out on Patreon. There's like, I don't know, like 170 episodes on there right now. TV recaps, just the whole nine. So just go check it out over there. All the links are in the notes, blah, blah, blah. Now, before I get into Gone in 60 Seconds, which is a 2000 film, so I figured it's at the end of the 90s. Most likely it was filmed in 99, so that's how I made the cutoff. I have to talk about something really, really topical because it just came out today. Today is the 14th of March. This is going to come out on Sunday, so it'll be a few days, but maybe you've seen it until then. But the trailer, the 3-minute trailer, which when did we start making trailers 3 minutes? Like, tell us the whole goddamn movie, but The Crow, which, as many of my friends know, and I don't think I talk about it that much online, a little bit, I'm super just upset and kind of heartbroken at what this new Crow is looking like just based on the stills. But I figured, well, I'll give it a chance. I mean, the trailer isn't out yet, so maybe they're going to change my mind. The trailer came out today. Go check it out. If you haven't seen it yet, then just pause this and then go on YouTube and look it up and then come back. Okay, here's the thing. I'm torn on it. I'm torn because I will never see another Crow besides the first one. I have not seen City of Angels and the other two that like went straight to DVD that were just nothing like the original story. I think it's because I have such a deep connection to the Crow, like the original one. I played it all the time. It came out when I was 11, but I was into it for a good like 5 years. Like the soundtrack was incredible. And it was just something I'd never seen before. I mean, it still isn't. I feel like it's still at the level where it just has a different feel. And it's really kind of the blueprint for that gothic, dark comic book conversion filmed like world that they ended up doing. Like Blade is one of the other films that really remind me of that, which was like 4 years later in 98. But it just really was a vibe. Like, I think unintentionally, it really created a blueprint. I think even the recent Joker, the Heath Ledger Joker, and I feel like the Joaquin Joker have roots in that Alex Proyas version of The Crow with Brandon Lee. So I tried to keep an open mind on it. I knew that they were going to expand the love story between Eric and Shelley, which, not to say that it's not needed, but I feel like, okay, if that's what you want to do, but I feel like it is such a singular film. We're really following Eric Draven, and I feel like his need for revenge is adequately explained by the fact that they murdered and tortured him and his girlfriend. I don't feel like I need to see more of their relationship in order to feel even more like anger and revenge. I guess the way they did it in the original one I thought was perfect, because we just had these flashbacks and we had these moments of what they really meant to each other. The new one just looks like a Gen Z John Wick. I mean, it just looks like a typical revenge story, which is interesting because Chad Stahelski ended up, was the stunt double for Brandon Lee that finished his scenes when he died on the set. So that's really interesting too, that it seems like a John Wick. Like, it seems like a formula at this point, and they probably just wanted someone that was younger. Bill Skarsgård, great actor. And FKA Twigs, I don't know about her acting. I haven't seen her or anything. I think she's cool. But I think Danny Houston looks like the villain. I mean, I would like to say that I'm curious about it, but I don't know. I'm really of a mind that is just, it's not going to have the same effect. So I'm curious what everyone else thinks about it. I was kind of like, a little piece of me like kind of died a bit, because just the soundtrack was great. And I feel like I've talked about this before, the way that soundtracks are not featured in the same way that they used to be, where it doesn't propel the story. I mean, think about the Crow soundtrack. Think about when you listen to that album from front to back, that it moves you within the story. Like, that's how incredible that soundtrack is. You even have the, what do you call it? The club, like Top Dollar's Club in the first Crow, where you have like the band Medicine performing and you have My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult that tie into all the scenes that are about to happen. I mean, I don't know. I can't see it being like that. And I can't imagine the trailer is cut completely differently than how straightforward the film feels. I feel like the original one just feels so much more mysterious and suggestive and kind of open to interpretation. And this one is kind of like, here's a guy, he was killed, he's taking revenge, the Crow is his spirit guide. But it's in a very like kind of, I don't know, plain way, like straightforward way. But enough about that. So I'm curious if you out there have seen The Crow. So if you haven't, then go check it out. But I'm here to talk Gone in 60 Seconds. Okay, so in the late 90s, we had kind of like a random renaissance of action movies. Like I've done a few. Like I've done like Demolition Man from like 93, and I don't think I've done any, like Mission Impossible was one that was Brian De Palma. But then we really got a taste, or for me anyway, I don't want to say we as a society, me as a child, got a taste of the world of Jerry Bruckheimer, which was like, he's a producer and he was like so, so huge in that everything was big budget. Like he's along the lines of like a Michael Bay in terms of like over the top explosions, action that's just boom, 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 like just keeps you going. And it just really over the top, but not necessarily like just action. The world that he creates kind of looks the same. Like Gone in 60 Seconds is shot in this very kind of like a warm yellow filtered, where everything looks really hot and sweaty. He also does this a lot in a lot of his other films and even TV shows. He produced CSI, and one of my favorite CSI was CSI Miami, and it's shot the exact same way that this movie is. It's all, it looks like it's hot and sticky, and it just has that kind of, I feel like it's a Bruckheimer thing. Bruckheimer also produced like the original Pirates of the Caribbean, so he does like massive like Disney budgets, like hundreds of millions of dollars. So I can see why this would appeal to him. Now we have this coming out in 2000, and then in 2001 The Fast and the Furious, the first one, comes out. Who knew that Fast and Furious was going to be the one that ended up a franchise that we still have right now, and they're on like 10 or 11 and spinoffs and whatever. So interestingly enough, I love Timothy Oliphant, who is in this film. He's one of the detectives, and he was on with Conan. I love Conan O'Brien, and he is really good friends with Conan. So he was talking about how he turned down the role of Dominic Toretto in Fast and Furious for this film, I think because he thought like this was gonna be like the one that had the sequels, and he was like, yep, that's me, I kind of made that mistake, I totally thought this is the one that's gonna have the sequels and not the other one, not Fast and Furious. So that's why he's in this one. It is kind of weird that he was offered a lead in Fast and Furious, but this one he's such a semi-supporter. Like he's not even a supporting character, he's like underneath the supporting character, but he's there, but he's also not a really big part of the story, which is crazy. I love Timothy Oliphant. Like, I love him. So
any time to watch him, I'm totally happy with. But so yeah, this is like a Bruckheimer thing. This is directed by Dominic, I think it's Senna. I always thought it was Cena, but I think it's Senna. He directed California with a K, that crazy ass movie that we covered on episode 78 with Brad Pitt, David Duchovny, and Juliette Lewis. It is like the craziest road trip film. It's from 93. If you haven't seen it, go look it up. I think it's on like Tubi or something. It's on like one of those streamers. California is nuts. And if you want to see Brad Pitt in a completely different role, he took it after he did Thelma and Louise. So he didn't really want to be known as this kind of heartthrob guy. I think he was more like, hey, I can act. I can be more than this like pretty boy that you all see me as. And he definitely does that. He is completely different in it. It's really wild. He also, Dominic Senna also did Swordfish, that film with like John Travolta and Halle Berry. I think it came out in like the mid or maybe early 2000s. It's another one. And basically, from what I've seen, he got a lot of his credits directing music videos, tons of Janet Jackson music videos. I mean, like Rhythm Nation. So Dominic Senna knows how to bring that like action and that kind of, I don't know, just that kind of mood with everything that he does. This film premiered June 9th, 2000. I was in high school. Now, for my first impressions, I don't remember when I actually saw this film. I want to say I might have seen it in the theater, but I don't remember. I didn't go to that many movies in high school. Like, not at the theater. I would rent a lot because I'm a super homebody. So I think I would rent a lot. Oh, also, speaking of homebody, because it took me 3 days to watch, I finally watched Killers of the Flower Moon. I was trying to watch a lot of the films that were nominated for Best Director, which was the Oscars were last Sunday. And I just didn't have time to watch Killers, but I watched it like in hour chunks. I thought it was a great story. I mean, not great story as in what happened. I thought that was actually really unsettling to watch. And it kind of made me really nauseous knowing that this was a true story. But I did love the story and I loved the acting. I have to say the standouts for me were definitely Lily Gladstone and Robert De Niro. For Leo, I don't think it was his best role that I've seen, but obviously he wasn't horrible. The film for me, though, and I think I might have tweeted this. I don't even know if I deleted it. Whatever. I think it really would have worked as a limited series on HBO. Like, it had that production value and it had that level. But for me, watching it, even in parts, it was entirely too slow of a pace for a film that's 3+ hours. Like, I could feel every minute of the 3.5 hours. When there's some other films that he's done, The Irishman was the same way. That I thought would have worked really well as a series. But like Wolf of Wall Street, I happen to love, and that was 3 hours, but I didn't know it was 3 hours because it was just like super engaging and just crazy and crazy and crazy and crazy. So I was like, oh, this is really cool. But this one, I just felt like you kind of needed, or at least for me in like the watching experience, I really needed time to kind of sit with what was actually going on because it was just so tragic and awful. So I couldn't just watch one thing after another just happen in tandem. So I think I liked the way that I watched it. I guess that's an upside of being able to watch things on your own, but I definitely highly recommend it. It's on Apple Plus right now. I'm really surprised it didn't win any Oscars at all. Like, it is actually kind of sad. I did love Poor Things and I loved Emma Stone's role and I thought she did incredible. I wish we could have split the Oscar in two, honestly, and given it to Lily as well. But you know, I hope to see more from them in the future. So I think that would be really cool. So yeah, a side note. I'm pretty sure I rented this movie. So even giving you more backstory, when I was in, I don't even know when it happened. If you don't know this about me, because you probably don't, if you've never met me or spent time, I'm obsessed with driving. Now, I love to drive. I love cars. I'm not opposed to spending a long time in a car. I've driven across the U.S., so I just love being in cars. So I was really, really into cars and into like modified cars and into like, I don't want to say I knew a little bit of technical things about cars, but not where I was like working on cars or a mechanic by any means. But I was really interested in like the visual aesthetics and I was buying like Import Tuner magazine and like Sport Super Compact magazine and looking at like the Ferrari GT3s and being like, oh, I really want this car. Like, I'd love an M3. I'd love like all these BMWs I was looking into. So I was into cars. So when this film was even released as a trailer, I was like, oh my God, cars. Obviously, I just got my license in 99. So I was new to driving. And then this was really cool. Just seeing all these insane cars in this film. I don't think anything like that had been released in this timeline, like in the 90s or this decade. So I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. Nicolas Cage. I mean, I have to read off the credits because it's kind of insane, the cast of this film. We have Nicolas Cage, Angelina Jolie, Giovanni Ribisi, Vinnie Jones, Will Patton, Christopher Eccleston, TJ Cross, Scott Kahn, Delroy Lindo, Chi McBride, Scott Rosenberg, James Duvall, Timothy Oliphant, William Lee Scott, Michael Pena is in a scene. Those are like the basics, but it's pretty fucking huge. I mean, just the fact that you have Nicolas Cage and Angelina, who are probably two of my favorite actors, who are like so off the wall, that I'm really glad that they worked well together and had really great chemistry for the purpose of this film, because they were so, so good together. So this is, I mean, there's so many cars on my list that I would get if, you know, I had like $1 billion. Like, I want like a Barracuda, which was this really cool car that I think is in the film. They steal it. And I think it's also the car in Nash Bridges. If anybody watched Nash Bridges, it was a detective show starring Don Johnson and Cheech Marin that was on CBS on like a Saturday or a Friday night. I used to watch with my mom. He had a bright yellow Cuda, and it was this convertible, and he was driving all around San Francisco. It was so cool. It also really reminded me of Bullet, the famous Steve McQueen like film noir, where he has the Shelby Mustang, which is also what Nicolas Cage drives here famously, which we'll get to. But yeah, I mean, it just, I've loved driving fast. I love doing like donuts. I would love to be a stunt driver, or at least not even a stunt driver, but I'd love to take just like stunt driving school that they get to take when they're actors and stuff, and do these car movies. I think it's so cool. So I'm into this genre. I was also very into Fast and Furious, and that was more my wheelhouse. Like, I was looking into more of the like modified cars and different car mods and like body kits and shit like that for cars, and like external lights and things like that. Somewhat of like the nitrous tanks I was like knew about. I knew about like the Nissan Skyline, which was this car in Japan that was imported here, which was in the Fast and the Furious. So that I will definitely do, because that film I saw multiple times in the theater, and it was like my like hobby awakening. It wasn't like a sexual awakening. I never really felt that way about Paul Walker, but it was like this hobby that had been in the pages of magazines that was like translated into what I was looking at on screen. Like, I was going to street races. I was like in, you know, somewhat in that world. I went to college, and one of my friends in college had this BMW M3, and we went out like racing in the Bronx, and the cops broke us up, very similar in the way that it happens in the Fast and Furious, where everyone scatters and just jumps in cars. That's a whole other story for another day. But so I was into this, like this was kind of my world, you know? So I was like really, really into it. So this was more of the classic vibe. It wasn't like street racing. This was more of like, they're boosting all these cars, but they're all these cars I'd never seen before, because I live in DC. When I moved to LA, it was kind of nuts how many crazy cars I would see that we obviously would never see here. So I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. All these like wild classic cars that everybody works out or works on there. So this is also based on a 1974 version, which I've seen parts of, but if you love classic cars, I would say definitely watch the 70s version. That is, I think, on Tubi right now, and it's a different, I mean, it's not as high budget, but I mean, you got these amazing cars in the 70s. Like, you literally have these amazing classic cars, so, which they have in this 2000 version too, but I mean, you just kind of have a different vibe, because it's different when you see these cars that are new at the time. So I hope I'm not boring too many people with a lot of the car talk, but I'll move on. So yeah, this is just, this is one of my favorites. I mean, this is my first impression, is that, you know, I think Sway, Angelina Jolie's character, really informed a lot of my personality in a way that I didn't realize until I was watching this earlier today. I own this on DVD. I own like the unrated director's cut, whatever that, I think it means this is like 9 minutes. It's not like anything. It's not like it's a different film or anything, but as I was watching it, I was like, no, I like wanted to be Sway. Like, I loved everything about her. I love that she was like, quote unquote, like a tomboy, but she could like work on cars. And at the time, I think I was like 16, and I was like, man, I'd love to work and be a Ferrari mechanic. Like, what the hell? That would be so cool. So yeah, I think that really informed so much of it. And I had like a little baby crush on Nicolas Cage. So I think I was also just like, damn, and she gets to be with Nicolas Cage. This is so cool. I think Castor Troy, his character in Face Off, which was like 2 or 3 years before this, I think that was like my awakening for Nicolas Cage. I like thought he was so hot as Castor Troy. So I think I was like, damn, man, she gets to be with Castor. This is so cool. So yeah, I mean, Giovanni Ribisi has always been kind of one of those, like, I want to say heartthrob adjacent guys of the 90s. Like, what really stands out to me when I first heard him was when he was narrating The Virgin Suicides. And he has such a distinctive voice that it couldn't be anyone else. So I feel like I was also kind of attached to him too. Scott Kahn, I was attached to because he's in Nowhere, the Gregoraki's Nowhere, as is James Duval. So I think that was really cool. And then Timothy Oliphant had been in Go in 99. And then he'd also been in Scream 2. And he had been in maybe like one other thing. So this was like kind of my like heartthrob cast too. Like this had a great cast. Christopher Eccleston, I didn't know at the time. I later saw him in Legend, that film with Tom Hardy where he plays those two twin gangsters from like the 60s in London. He's in that. And then he also is the villain in Thor, The Dark World, the second Thor film, which I happen to love, which is like everyone's least favorite Marvel film, but I happen to love The Dark World. But yeah, he's like the villain in that one. And I think he's pretty great. Vinnie Jones, famously in Guy Ritchie films. I think he'd done Lock, Stock, and I think Snatch. I think he'd filmed before this. I don't know if it was out yet. So yeah, I mean, we have like a pretty incredible cast that I'd already kind of come in knowing, which was really great too. So yeah, I guess now we move on to behind the scenes. I mean, there's a lot. I have the DVD, as I mentioned. There's a lot on, there was this weird like feature on Jerry Bruckheimer, and he was talking about like what a producer actually does, which I thought was kind of cool. Like, I think it was just an overall kind of a like 10-minute bit on him as a person and him as a director and how he chooses and how he talks about how the producer is like the manager of the set. Like, it's not his idea, but it's like his kind of role, his or her, you know, role to make sure that everyone on this team that they put together is doing the best that they can for this project. So, okay. That was cool. It talks about, you know, different things that he worked on and how he got this to do everything. Okay, so for this, Rotten Tomatoes gives us a 25%. That's what the critics give it. Now, I mean, I don't know like what you're judging it against. This is one of those just summer feel-good films. I mean, it's really exciting. I feel like every scene where they're stealing cars, the soundtrack is great. This is just one of those great films that you go to on a weekend. I don't really see how it's a 25. I mean, yeah, the story's not perfect. It's, you know, a little bit, it's not like Fast and Furious, which was Point Break. I mean, Point Break with, you know, aftermarket cars and like street racing. That's basically what that was. This, I feel like, was, yeah, a remake of the 1974 version, but it had its own, you know, it had its own, like a family connection. It had a deeper story than I feel like anything we got with Fast and Furious. Like, I know the family is the connection in Fast and Furious. Like, everyone outside of Paul Walker, it was like Dom and I forgot the sister's name, Jordana Brewster, but you know, like, and then Letty, like, I mean, they're like a found family, you know, like that's part of family. But this one I feel like was so much more intense because you have like Nicolas Cage, who's the older brother, who is this like master car thief. And then Kip is the younger brother played by Giovanni. And he like wants to, well, he left Memphis, who's, I'm gonna start using their character names, Memphis, Nicolas Cage. He leaves because he was really, really close to getting caught last time he was boosting cars. So then Kip, as he's left, Kip is like fill the void, and now he's boosting cars and he fucks up on a job and essentially he's gonna get killed if he doesn't complete it. So there's way more stake, I think, in this one. Like in Fast and Furious, it was like DVDs are being stolen off trucks and we need to find these cars that are stealing them. It's like, okay, but like no one has died. Like, or no one is being threatened to be killed by a drug lord because they like fucked up this order of like boosting cars. I mean, I feel like it had a more robust story. Yeah, it might have been a little flashy and a little like, out of the, or, you know, over the top, but the actors, I think, really made it believable. I feel like it was Fast and Furious acting was a little like cheesier. Like that film in general is a lot cheesier, I think, than this. Like Paul Walker, like rest his soul, he wasn't the caliber of actor like Nicolas Cage or even Giovanni Ribisi to carry, and definitely not Angelina Jolie. And Robert Duvall, I forgot Robert Duvall's in this, to even carry a film like that. So I feel like this one just has better acting talent. The story might not be perfect, but I feel like the acting talent is what really like gives it that extra edge for me. So I prefer this film actually over Fast and Furious, but I do like them for different reasons, but I like this one. Okay, so audience score is 77%, which is more like it. Like, that's where you can see the real divide between Rotten Tomatoes. So it's kind of funny. IMDb gives it a 6.5 out of 10, which is, you know, I mean, I've come to grips that, yeah, that everyone's not going to like it, and it's not really a big deal, and, you know, that's just how it is, you know? It's just like, what can you do? What can you do? Let's see. And then Letterboxd gives this a 2.9 out of 5, which is crazy. I mean, is it that bad? Like, I have really weird taste in films. Like, some movies I feel like I'll hate. Like, for instance, I don't want to watch this new Crow, but I feel like a lot of people would be like, you won't watch The Crow, but you'll watch, like, Gone in 60 Seconds? And I'm like, yeah. Like, or, like, Demolition Man. I'm like, yeah, it's fucking classic. Like, it's actually kind of nuts. Like, this is just a really, really fun movie. So, I don't know. I still love it. I just still love it. Okay, so the budget was $90 million, which I have to think was a lot of the payments for most of these like high caliber actors. We have 3 Oscar winners. We have Robert Duvall, Angelina Jolie, and Nicolas Cage. So I can't imagine that their quotes were cheap. And the cars in this fucking movie is just to even rent them and to make sure that they aren't damaged, I feel like alone having the insurance for all of these cars and for everything that happened, and even like the really, for nowadays standards, the bad CGI they did on that bridge jump at the end. But I mean, that has to have cost a lot of money in 2000. I mean, they were still shooting on film, I'm pretty sure, at that time. So I mean, it has to have been like way cheaper, or I mean, way more expensive. So the box office is $237 million. So they made money. So I don't think this was like a bad one. So, okay. So I know how I was reading some Letterboxd reviews, and I said, let me just see what's up. So Zach Cheney wrote for Gone in 60 Seconds on Letterboxd, after Nick Cage goes all Zen Buddhist listening to Lowrider, then opens his eyes and says, let's ride. I told my wife to bury me with the Blu-ray of this movie. Oh, I thought that was really funny. Another one says, let's see, from A.M. Hayes says, not good, but still awesome. Most people comment about Angelina Jolie. Someone says, calling it boosting cars is so dorky. And then someone says, this review may cause spoilers. They took way longer than 60 seconds, which I thought was funny. And then someone else says Bruckheimer films are so very missed. I mean, I don't know what happened. I'm going to like in real time look this up. Cause like, what happened to Jerry Bruckheimer? Like, I actually don't know. I hope I'm not going to find out something like kind of wild, but it's like, when did he just like stop? Maybe he didn't stop doing films. Like, I think he has like, Beverly Hills Cop coming out. And then he has like Bad Boys 4, but I guess the type of action that we like now is very different than the type of action we liked before. Like, oh, so he produced Top Gun Maverick, like the recent one that was out, and all of the Pirates films. And I'm just looking now, like, oh, he produces like The Amazing Race and National Treasure, Edge of History, some TV show. Oh, he has a shit ton of things coming up. I guess they're doing another CSI Vegas. It looks like, yeah, just like I mentioned with Bad Boys, Enemy of the State. Yeah, he has like a lot of TV shows in development. So I guess he's still working, but most of these things that have come out in like the 2010s, I think I haven't seen any of these. So I just kind of didn't know where he was. But yeah, it's CSIs and all that kind of stuff. So we're really missing these type of films in the landscape. Like, we do kind of now, they're replaced by the Mission Impossibles and like the Top Gun that we just had. But now we have a more like, I feel like the movie going experience is so different now because of things like what we're doing here, like podcasts. You have a lot of people really delving into the real nitty gritty of, you know, the meanings of things, and things aren't as, I mean, we do have things that are fun, but they kind of have a more overarching message. Like even Oppenheimer, right? Like, that's different. It's a biopic. It's way more of a drama, but we have kind of an overarching like morality dangling in the balance, which I feel like we didn't really have here. Like, there was never a morality issue in this film. It was like, we're stealing cars because we don't want the guy to die. Forget about like whether or not this is right or not. I mean, we're not hurting anybody. So they're, most of these are classic cars. They're going to file insurance. Like, it'll be fine. But I feel like now things are either, actually, I take this back. Things are either like really sinister in like a fucked up way, or they're like overly overcorrect sometimes. I feel like we don't have just like fun for the sake of being fun, or it just depends on what it is. Like, everything is kind of really heightened because I think there's more of a risk now for films, and there are more places to put them now. You have streamers and YouTube, and you know, traditional theaters are like a toss up. Like, is anyone going to see it? Like, so you kind of, I guess you have to change your whole thing. Like, here you had a theater run, but then you also had the DVD sales. So you knew you were going to make it up. So I don't know. I guess it's just, you know, it's the way that evolution works. Let's see. I already mentioned to you about Timothy Oliphant, which I thought was really funny. So, okay, they made 7 Eleanor replicas. Now, Eleanor is, they call up all these classic car names, women's names, so that when they're on the walkies and stuff, like, no one, if they intercept, they don't know what they're talking about. Like, if the cops listen. So Eleanor is like his white whale, is Memphis's white whale. It's almost impossible for him to steal and get to the next location safely. Like, something always happens. Something always gets in the way. So Eleanor is a Shelby GT Mustang. So for this, which is the one that does that jump at the end on the bridge, they made 7 of these bodies of replicas of these cars. So 5 of them were total during filming. There were 2 left. One was given to Nicolas Cage, and Jerry Bruckheimer has the other one. According to IMDb, Jerry Bruckheimer is terrified to even drive it, so he doesn't. And then Nicolas Cage takes it out all the time. So I think that was really funny. And because of this, Nicolas Cage trained even more than most of the other actors in stunt driving for this film, and he does most of his stunt driving because of that. And he loved it so much that after the film, he ended up taking it up as a hobby, which is amazing. I mean, I think one of the things in Death Proof, when I was watching Death Proof, the Tarantino film, which is like top tier, I was like, I want to be like these stunt people. Like, I want to be the girl driving, and I don't want to be the girl on the hood of the car, but I definitely want to be the girl driving, like in that chase with Kurt Russell, like with Stuntman Mike. Like, I just even watch that last like 20 minutes of that film sometimes, like just because I love it. Another film that I loved too, and seeing like women drive these amazing cars, is like Mad Max. Like, I would have taken Charlize's role in Fury Road, and I can't wait for the new Furiosa film. So anything like that, any like weird driving these crazy rigged cars, I would love to be able, even for apocalypse purposes, just to be able to drive anything. I really love too that moment in The Matrix where I think it's Trinity is like walking up to some car and she's like, I don't know how to drive, or maybe it's the helicopter, and then they like download the instruction to her, like how to fly a helicopter, and she just goes, okay, let's go. And then she just gets in the car or gets in the copter and just turns it on and just knows how to drive it. Like, whenever AI happens with Neuralinks, and if in my lifetime it's not dangerous, I want to be implanted with that knowledge of being able to drive anything on wheels, or even without wheels, like even to fly a fighter jet. Like, that's fine. Like, if I have to, I would love to have that knowledge just instantly. Instant knowledge. What would your instant knowledge be if you can think, like, if someone could give you instant knowledge, like a download, like, what would you want to be able to do in a second? I would want to drive or ride anything or fly anything. It'd be super cool. Okay, so Nicolas Cage does so much stunt driving in this that even the final chase scene was largely improvised, which is nuts because the final chase scene is like 15 minutes and he goes from the streets to a bridge to like a shipping yard. So I don't know how that could be improvised, because he had to like duck and weave and dodge all these like concrete planks flying and like people going through walls and shit, and then cops following after. And Castlebeck is the main detective, Delroy Lindo, who's after him like hot on his tail. He totals the BMW. Delroy Lindo, the actor, totaled that car, the BMW 5 Series that he's driving when he's chasing Memphis. That was totaled in production. I thought that was kind of crazy. And yeah, it was just like, it's just kind of nuts. Now, Christopher Eccleston plays Caletri, who's like the big villain who's ordered all these cars. For some weird, like, he's something about like his friend is going to be sent somewhere if he doesn't do this. I'm assuming they're going to like torture and kill his friends. That's why he has to do this. He actually does not like the film. Later on in like a Doctor Who convention, apparently someone was like, "Oh, I know you. You were in Gone in 60 Seconds." And he was like, "Yeah, that was a terrible film and I was terrible in it." I don't think he was terrible in it. I did read another thing that he didn't have his driver's license, which I thought was also really funny, that he did a film about stealing cars and didn't know how to drive a car. I think he got one eventually. But he also talks in, I didn't know what type of accent it was, but I read in IMDb that it's a Lancashire accent, which I don't know if that's up north. The UK people can tell me, but so he spoke in his like native accent, which is interesting. I always liked it. I thought it was cool. I thought he was a good villain. I mean, it was kind of an over-the-top weird movie. Like, when you work with Cage, I feel like he must be so fun to work with because I feel like he's so unpredictable in the best way. I loved seeing him on the Oscars stage last week because he's won his Oscar, I believe, for Leaving Las Vegas in like 95 or 6, whenever that came out, which was incredible. We reviewed that a little while ago on the pod, but I just liked seeing his energy there. Like how him and all the other actors were like passing the torch to Killian. Like, I thought that was a nice touch that they did that with the former winners. And I'm so stoked that Killian won. Like, I was really nervous that Paul Giamatti was going to win for a second. And I like Paul Giamatti, but I was like, it's Killian's turn, please. We can't do this. And if Bradley Cooper won, I was going to actually like eat my hat. So I'm glad I didn't have to do that. But I was like, oh God, Killian has to win. So thank God he did. But yeah, I love seeing him there. So yeah, I mean, another thing too, which I find interesting, is that the original writer had some conflict with Dominic Senna and I guess walked off of the shoot. And two writers, Jonathan Hensley and J.J. Abrams of Felicity fame, is what I know him from. Most people know him from Star Wars. I think that's what he writes a lot of now. And big but like what Cloverfield, I think he did that movie, like big budget stuff. But I know him from Felicity. I don't know how he wrote him and Matt Reeves. I don't know how they wrote in the mind of a young adult woman going to college so well. Like, it actually is eerie that it was so spot on and it wasn't written from like a woman's journal. Like, it freaks me out how good it was. So also, there's a Felicity podcast that just started on Spotify. I think it's one of their sponsored ones. It's so cool. Greg Grunberg, who plays the fuck's his name, Sean. And I believe Megan, I think they're on it. And the first episode has Carrie Russell and Scott Speedman. So it's bookmarked in my queue. I can't wait to listen to it. You all know how much I love Felicity. So I'm super fucking stoked about that. So yeah, J.J. Abrams came up and rewrote it. I think they're not credited in the writing, but they did. The role of Sway was written specifically for Angelina Jolie. I mean, how cool is she? The fact that you get this written exactly for you, and it is her. I mean, she also was very obsessed with cars. I think they said she was driving like some classic Ford truck when she took the movie. Like, she's also very into cars, so she was super stoked. And she just sounds so cool. Like, I mean, Angelina just sounds like the coolest person in the world, not to mention all of her films. I didn't realize until doing this podcast and having to really examine all the different films that I do for, you know, different actors. And I'm an actor first person. I forgot. I think I was talking to the Black Girl Film Club and I was like, are you a story person? Like, do you look for the story in the film first and that decides if you're going to see it? Or do you look for the actors? And I think one of them was saying, like, you know, story. I think maybe both of them were kind of like more story. And I felt, not that I feel bad, but I feel so weird that so much of what I love is really tied into the actor. Like, as most people know, if there's an actor that I don't like, or, you know, just not a fan of for whatever reason, it really blocks me from seeing it. Or if I just get annoyed, like, for instance, like, I really am into Austin Butler now because I saw Dune 2 and he was an incredible villain. I have no interest in seeing Elvis because I've been seeing him as that role, and I'm watching Masters of the Air on Apple Plus, which is really good. And I just like seeing him in not the role that people were like harping, like freaking and shoving down our throats when that was out. And I don't care about Elvis at all. I love Priscilla because it wasn't about Elvis. And Jacob Elordi was a great Elvis. He was a great like supporting character, but I just don't care at all about his music and like how he came up. And, you know, it's just of no interest to me. And the music is no interest to me either. So I don't like really want to listen to all of his music for 2 hours. And for me, Baz Luhrmann has been, I only really like Romeo and Juliet from Baz Luhrmann, like hot take. I'm not a Moulin Rouge girl. Yeah, it's just Romeo and Juliet was just such a big part of my like adolescence, and I guess even like cinematic awakening, you could say. Like I had never seen anything like that before, so I think that was another thing that just was like, whoa. And then it was Shakespeare, and then it was funny. I was talking to Jules the other day, and she was like, I never really get like, you know, feral over celebrities. I love that feral is like the new term that I'll use when I have a crush on someone. I'm like, no, I'm feral for them. It's like wild. And she's like, yeah, I never really got the thing. She's like, I like Jacob Elordi. He's cool. But she's like, Leo from Romeo and Juliet. I was like, oh, really? She's like, I still just can't believe it. I was like, girl, you don't even know. Like in the 90s, I mean, you want to talk like pandemonium? Like it was Leo. Like he was pandemonium. It was wild. So I feel like in that way, I've seen a lot of Leo movies, but actually not many of his later ones. There are a lot of films that I haven't seen that I feel like, I said this to someone the other day. I was like, I feel like my whole life, and even talking to other people, I need to figure out some other hobbies because I'm just so into television and film. And now even more of like it just kind of overtakes my life in a way, but not a way. And I feel like I'm always constantly telling people what to watch, and then they're constantly telling me what to watch, and it's never something I'm going to actually watch. And I'm like phantomly adding it to my Letterboxd, like, oh yeah, look, I'm putting it in my watch list. I'm like, I'm never going to watch this. But I feel like that's what happened to me the other day. I was talking about Nicolas Cage, and they're like, have you even seen Raising Arizona? I was like, no, I haven't. I was like, look, it's impossible for me to have seen everything. Like, you do know that there are a lot of things I haven't seen. A lot of 80s movies I have not seen. And because I didn't see them in the 80s, I have no like childhood nostalgia. And I don't think it's going to do anything for me. So E.T., for instance, I've never seen and don't care about because I'm older. Like, I'm not going to have that whimsy that people had when they watched it when they were like 7 or 10. Like, I just didn't watch it. I think I thought it was scary or something. I was a real scaredy cat when I was younger. So I feel like I was freaked out by the alien, and I was like, I don't want to see this. I don't know what this is, but nah, doesn't look like my vibe. But I did watch The Crow. So I was like, this I want. Like, this revenge, like, murderous plot, like, with this angel, like, this beautiful angel avenging, like, himself and his murder and his fiance's murder. Like, this I'm about. This gothic shit, this soundtrack, The Cure, Nine Inch Nails, like, this I'm about. So I guess that really informed what my childhood was like, because, yeah, that I was about. Okay, I need to move on because it's been like, what, 43 minutes and I haven't even, I'm still on behind the scenes. I mean, I thought, I was really nervous to do this episode. I was like, God, how am I going to talk about myself forever? But I feel like I probably do this all the time. Like in the car, I think I'm constantly working out scenarios and conversations. So maybe this is fine. This is going to work out. Oh, so also for Patreon, I'm probably going to upload this on Patreon first. And then, yeah, this will be out on Sunday, but I'm going to also review the pilot of Peaky Blinders, another film that I couldn't get anyone to watch, or not film, a series. Now, Jai's watched it, but Jai is still on mat leave, so she'll be coming back at some point. And I am going to do a fashion episode, but I feel like, I don't know, like, I've seen so much discourse with, like, the McQueen show and, like, you know, just all this stuff this is like post fashion month now. So I feel like I might just do some highlights or just like general fashion with maybe some fashion weeks like spliced in. It'll probably be a solo episode. And just to keep people in the loop, or not really in the loop. I mean, if you follow fashion, you already know, but just to kind of keep my hand in the game, I kind of dip in and out of fashion. Like one season I'll be really, really into it and pay a lot of attention. Then the next season I'm like completely removed and taken out, and I'm watching like war pictures, like what I'm doing right now. I like got really into war pictures after watching Masters of the Air, and I was watching like, you know, Dunkirk, and then I was watching like all these old 60s war films and stuff. So I was like really out of the loop when Fashion Week was around. And then I didn't want to listen to a bunch of recaps because I didn't really want that to sway my opinion and what I thought. So I am going to do like probably a mini episode. I might even do like a short one or something. And that way I'll still have it out. But yeah, Peaky Blinders is going to be on the Patreon soon. I'm probably going to end up recording that tomorrow. So yeah, if you really like that series, and you should, if you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. It's fucking incredible from beginning to end. It's Cillian Murphy, who's everywhere now, but Tommy Shelby. It's fucking dope. Okay, also, back to behind the scenes. So Dominic, the director, said that when he was thinking about all of the roles for like the movie, you know, and he saw the interaction between Nicolas Cage and Giovanni Ribisi, he said that they worked so well together as brothers on the set that they kind of like twisted the dialogue that they were given, and they did just such a great job that he said they even looked like brothers by the end of the shooting. So I thought that was really great. And the bridge, that's the famous jump shot that we see in the end with the Mustang, or with Eleanor, that is the Vincent Thomas Bridge, which connects, I believe, the Long Beach Harbor to like the LA Harbor or Pier or whatever. That bridge, which I had no idea, is director Tony Scott, who I had no idea was the brother of Ridley Scott. Tony Scott directed like True Romance. That's what I can think of right now. He committed suicide by jumping off of that bridge in 2012, which is crazy. I had no idea about that. I did mention before that 3 Oscar winners are in this film. And then the last tidbit I have is that Brad Pitt was considered for the lead role. So wouldn't that be crazy if him and Angelina had done that film together, like way before Mr. and Mrs. Smith? There's something about him, and this is all just opinion. I feel like Brad Pitt's a bad driver. I don't actually know or have any proof otherwise, but it's a hunch. Also, the way that he did that 3-point turn in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that Tarantino film, was like kind of sloppy. And I don't know if it was the lack of power steering in that Common Ghia or what, because I was like, how come he can't make this turn? He's kind of like falling out of this turn. Like, keep that. When you like make a turn and you kind of spin out a little bit, you have to like keep your steering like kind of tight so that you can avoid that whale tail. You can avoid that like kind of fin flip. I don't know. It's too technical, but I feel like he might be kind of a meh driver. But I know he was doing that like Le Mans movie or like Formula One or some shit where he was out in that jumpsuit. So I don't know. Maybe he's taking like driving lessons. Maybe he's fine. I don't know. It's a hunch that I have. Okay, cool. Well, let's move on to fashion. You know, it's the best part of this whole shebang for me. Now, this isn't really a fashion film. Marlene Stewart is the costume designer here. Now, Marlene Stewart has done costumes for Top Gun 2, that's the most recent one, 21 Grams, another great film, The Holiday, Coyote Ugly, Tu Wong Fu, Terminator 2, The Doors, and she did the costumes for Madonna's Material Girl, like the music video. So she's amazing. I think that's really cool. Now for this one, I don't have that many notes. I wrote, this is very like mechanic core. I mean, you have a lot of those, like, I do love like the auto shop. Do you remember those auto shop shirts that were really big? Like the gas station shirts that were big in like the late 90s, like early 2000s. Even like in Dawson's Creek, Joey worked at like that fill up station in like season 3 or 4, where she was filling up the gas for boats. And she had on that really cool like blue uniform shirt that had one patch had like the yacht club and the other patch would say Joey. Like those, and we used to have the jumpsuits, you know, like the mechanics jumpsuits that are navy that you can pull on, like the Dickies, those kind of like mechanic jackets. Those were really big, like guys would wear them a lot. So yeah, I mean, that was kind of sort of a style, but also there were a lot of like road jackets. Everyone had on these leather, everyone had dark colors on, except for like a few random stragglers, but most people had blacks. Most things were done at, a lot of things were done at night. Even when they weren't, everyone was wearing black. Like Memphis always had on a black trench coat and like a black, just like rib shirt and black pants. Like everybody just had on kind of black. Sunglasses were a big thing. They looked like they were like Persols or maybe like Ray-Bans or something. Like those were, that was the kind of vibe. I loved Angelina's like twists that she had in the beginning. Like her hair was bleach blonde and it was in these twists. And then eventually it kind of got straightened out throughout the film. It was like those like dread looking twists that Alanis Morris had had in the You Learn video, which was kind of big in the, at that time, which was neat. Sway, just, which is Angelina, she, at the end, she has on this white, like oversized, really crisp shirt that looks like it has a stencil on the front. Like it's white, but it has something in black on a stencil. And she has these really cool, like black leather pants on. She just looks dope. She also has the leather trench. They all have like the leather trench, like a leather three-quarter coat, which is cool. Scott Kahn, who is in Hawaii Five-0 and also in Nowhere, plays Ducky. He at one point had like a black, almost like a wool coat, but he had this bright red button-down shirt underneath it. In that, in this movie, they say he's like built like a boxer. He does have one of those like muscle shirts that looks like a mechanic shirt where you cut the sleeves off of. I think that's when you first meet him and he's in the garage and he's like throwing stuff around. But like Atlee had on the leather coat, like everyone, Robert Duvall, his character Otto, he has like a workman's outfit. So he has a really cool denim shirt, but then he has that waist, like a waist pack, but it's like has all of his tools in it. And it's like a kind of a light leather, which looks really cool. Let's see, a lot of beanies. I mentioned Sonny's Sphinx, who's Vinnie Jones. He has on like, he has such a dark, like European vibe, like with his clothes, like they're kind of like structured and like form fitting. I think later on he has like a tighter black shirt. And then he works in that morgue and he has like the white coat, you know? So he looks really cool too. But yeah, I mean, this was a dope fashion film, but really undercover because that wasn't the point. The point is the car. So this wasn't one of those things that was like the front and center. Now I think moving on to music, I think the music is like the second character after the cars in this film. Like this is, I talked about it before. This is another one of those things where the soundtracks were just on point at the time. I mean, as I mentioned several times, this is the time where it was a big selling point, I think, for the films to have a soundtrack that went along with it. I mean, that's probably the best part is when you, don't you remember, like, I mean, this is a long time ago, I'm really dating myself here, but don't you remember when you would go see a film at the theater and then the soundtrack was so good that you could run to the Sam Goody and just go buy it and then you would put it in your CD player in the car or when you get home or whatever and you listen to it and you remember what it's like to see the movie again? Like, where was that? I mean, I know, yeah, you can go to Spotify right now, but I feel like the steps that it took to get the CD, to go home, to put it in your boombox, whatever, and just to listen to it on your own time in a very like one-on-one personal way and not the way that music now is like, music now is so part of our lives that it's more of like a background multitask option for me. Like I have music on, but I'm usually doing something else. It's very rare that I'm just have music on and I'm just listening to it and not doing anything else. I'm usually just, I'm on the computer, I'm reading, or I'm typing something. Like I still have two things going at once. But I remember when I would get new albums, you know, didn't they used to come out on like Tuesdays? Like now they come out on Fridays, but I feel like they used to come out on Tuesdays. And but it was so different when I would like go to like a Tower Records on like Monday at midnight or like Monday night at midnight because it's Tuesday and you could buy the album. And then you like pop it in the car and you're like driving home and listening to this album for the first time of this band that you've been waiting years to get. Like what happened when Guns N' Roses came out? Like Use Your Illusion. And you heard about all these people like waiting in line. And it was just like, oh, you know, we've listened, we've waited for so long. We also didn't have access to celebrities like we do now. So we didn't know what they were doing. We were just waiting to find out when that date was, when that music's dropping, and then we can listen to it. So this one, this film has such an amazing soundtrack. I kind of forgot until I was watching it and actually Shazamming and writing everything down. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, this song is in it, like Crystal Method, Groove Armada. Like, this also was a time that I was going to like raves in 2000. I think me and Jai talked about our rave experience in one of the Patreon episodes where we talked about like UK raves and I was talking about my experience here on the East Coast and going to raves and stuff. So it was very like, this soundtrack really went with the time. So like, we open with Moby, the song Flower, the album Play. I remember when that album came out and I remember people in my high school and stuff being like, yeah, I got Play last night. Play also meant like hooking up too in the 90s. Like, yeah, I got some Play. So yeah, it was weird when people were like, yeah, I got Play last night. And it was like the Moby album. Like, it was like a really weird, stupid joke. But yeah, the intro and the credits, we have Moby's Flower. And then the very beginning, we open up with Kip boosting this Porsche from the dealership. And in that, we get Crystal Method song Busy Child, which was also on a VW commercial. It was on one of those commercials that was one of those, like, I don't think it was the khakis, like the Gap khakis. I'm pretty sure it was like a VW commercial that had that Busy Child, the Crystal Method, which I wrote down Chemical Brothers, but then I was like, oh no, it's Crystal Method. Okay, we have Groove Armada. It's called If Everybody Looked the Same, and that's when they're scouting all the cars. That's when that song was. We have Lowrider by War, another famous classic song. That was when we get that famous As the Boost Night Starts, and that's when, you know, Nicolas Cage and all them are like sitting around and they're like, Lowrider, Donnie, Lowrider, put on Lowrider. And then that's when he like zones out and he's like, okay, let's ride. Like, that's that song. We have Never Gonna Come Back Down, which is when they're stealing Ferraris. But I know that song is like a BT song, but it had no lyrics and it was a remix and it wasn't pulling up on Shazam and it's not on IMDb. I'm going to look that up. I'm pretty sure it's BT. Never Gonna Come Back Down. It is. God, so good. BT, Mike Dowdy, and Timo Maas. Yeah, it's on like, oh God. BT was like, oh God, I loved BT. If anybody knows that whole album, I think it was called, what is it? Extended Movement? I think that's the name of the album. But he also had one that was called like something. Hold on, I'm going to find it now. Movement and Still Life. That was another one. And that one had the song like, let's see. Like, yeah, Mercury and Solace, Godspeed, Dreaming. God, I'm re-listening to all this shit. Ugh. I also, you ever listen to like, I have a dude rock playlist, which basically is like bro nu metal. And some other stuff in there too, but basically pro nu metal. So yesterday I was with Jules and I was playing this song and she was like, what song is this? It's kind of good. And I was like, oh, I was like, really? And she's like, yeah, it's kind of good. What is it? So I like turned and it was like a Limp Bizkit song. I think it was like, like In Together Now, or like, it was one of those songs from Significant Other. And I just didn't say anything, but I turned and just showed her the phone. She was like, stop. I was like, I know. I was like, Limp Bizkit's pretty good. She's like, I actually like this song. God, what was it? Was it like Rearrange? It might have been Rearrange. It was one of those like kind of chiller songs. Yeah, I think it was like Rearrange. Yeah, it's really funny. That was like a Limp Bizkit song. I mean, Limp Bizkit was fucking it. I mean, I know it's like really embarrassing, and it's also really embarrassing to me that like Woodstock 99, as much of a shit show as it was, like when I was watching the documentaries and we did an episode on it a long time ago, and everybody was like, yeah, this music was like so lame. I was like, that's the thing, is like, I really liked this music. And I saw a few of these bands, some of them, not obviously at Woodstock, but like throughout, you know, the late 90s, I saw a lot of these bands. And I definitely feared for my life in a Limp Bizkit mosh pit at one time where I thought it was over. But I've never felt that feeling ever in my life again. And I don't want to say I'm chasing that kind of high, but I even posted on Instagram not too long ago, like the video of the Pearl Jam one of the Pearl Jam videos. This is how bad I am. I mean, I know it's fashion grunge, but I don't remember what song it was. I think it's like Alive. It's like either, I think it's the Alive song where Eddie is like, this is not a fucking mute. This is not a TV show. Turn those lights out. This is a rock concert. And everyone's like, yeah. And you just see like this sea of people. Like, and you can just feel that like energy that you used to have when you would see a band in like the 90s or like the 2000s. And I know this makes me sound super fucking lame, but just the energy that was coming off of the screen, even just my phone screen, like I was instantly transported back and no one had phones. Like no one had any technology in their hands. And you could just see everyone was just in the same place at the same time with this music. And now when I go to, I mean, I haven't been to like a big show in a long time, but when I was last at one and everyone had their phones out, I was like, guys, I wanted to just scream at the top of my lungs, like, guys, it's gonna be on YouTube tomorrow with professional angles. Put your goddamn phones away. You are not going to watch this video after tonight. I can guarantee you. You can save it on your YouTube. There's probably a professional camera guy wandering all over this whole set that you don't even see because you're so into this band. Put it away. Like you're gonna get a professional quality video. Like that's what you should be doing and be paying in the moment, paying attention to where you are right now, because this is what you got, you know? So yeah, that's just like that whole feeling. And then we have Apollo 440, Stop the Rock, which is that like can't stop the rock. That was on like commercials and stuff. Like that song was everywhere. It was like one of those like weird songs that you just heard everywhere. That was when they were like stealing more and more of the cars. We have like DMX Party Up, when they're when they like steal the Hummer and they push that car like off, they push the cop car I think like off the ramp. That was pretty funny. I think Vinnie Jones, the actor, said that he wasn't supposed to like knock the car off the ramp, but he like pushed it down anyway because he couldn't get through. And then as he was leaving, he was like, that'll teach ya. Like that's what he said to the stunt people. So that was great. We have Citizen King, Better Days. That was a big song. Like that was like one of those mid-tier radio songs. It's probably on like a Dawson's Creek episode. It was like one of those things. That's earlier actually when Memphis was calling his old crew, like trying to get people together. That song was playing in the back. We have Jane's Addiction, Been Caught Stealing, which is at the very end after the job was completed and everything. And then we have The Cult, Painted on My Heart. That is in the end credits, but it's also with Memphis and Sway when they're waiting for this guy to like have sex with his wife or something so they can steal the Lambo. And they're like outside his house. So that's where that one comes in. So yeah, incredible soundtrack, killer soundtrack. Definitely recommend. Fine holiday fun, as Travis Birkenstock says. Cool. All right. So now we're on to favorite scenes and lines. Wow. It's been an hour already. I guess I can gab. Okay. Let's see. So usually when I have another person here, we're kind of trading off what our favorite scenes were. I mean, I just have one page of notes here. I guess I'll go through. I mean, I have like four standouts, but it's basically all standouts, but so we start the film with this Porsche boost from the dealer. I was like, Kip is so dumb. Like, the fact that Kip is Memphis's brother, which we don't know yet when we start, but I was like, you're gonna steal a Porsche out of a dealership and break, like, first you throw a brick in it to get into the dealer. Then you break the actual window again by driving through it in the Porsche, and you expect there not to be cameras and a cop to be after you. Then you just start to street race some fucking souped up Civic, which is nuts, and that's what gets you caught, or that's what gets the cops to chase after you. So as he's doing this, he's like weaving through LA, going to his warehouse where his like buddies are there waiting for him to bring the car back. And this is when they're doing the big boost, right? Like they're doing like the big job. And then they bring the cops to the warehouse and essentially fuck everything up. They get away, but now the cars that they've stolen are there. The cops have them. And this is how like the investigation begins. Like, what's happening here? They find out that it's Memphis's brother. Memphis has been gone out of town for 6 years. Auto theft has gone down. So they're like, this is kind of suspect. So Atlee, who's one of the guys who Kip is working with, who used to also work with Memphis, who also works for Kalitri, the bad guy who ordered this whole thing, he goes up north to where Memphis has been hiding out for the last few years after he's like left town and managed to escape jail. And he tells him like, yo, Kip fucked up, the cops are after him, he couldn't complete this job, and now this guy's gonna kill him. So that's how Nicolas Cage like comes back into the story, and he basically has to steal 50 cars in like 3 days or they're gonna kill his brother. So he has no choice. He's backed up against a wall. He knows how to do it. The list is like 50 of the most exotic cars, including like these brand new Mercedes that have these laser cut keys that are impossible to get unless you know a dealer, which they do, who ends up flipping later. So there are a whole lot of like ins and outs with the story, which this is what I don't see the problem with. Like, this is a summer fun movie. Like, there weren't any holes. I felt like there were no plot holes. I was kind of given what I needed as far as backstory with the characters, but I also was really interested in how are they going to steal these cars? How do you get all these people together? How do they find out who has these cars? So you get a lot of like funny vignettes. I do love, my first favorite scene is when Memphis is in town to see his mom, who's a waitress at a diner, and these two cops see him. They see Memphis and they're like, oh fuck, like this is like the legendary car thief has come back. So they call Castle Beck, who's Delroy Lindo, and Timothy Oliphant. I don't even know Timothy's name in this movie. I think he's like detective, according to Google, Detective Drykoff. I mean, we never hear his name. So he's there, and that's when they catch up with him, and they're like, hey, you're in town. And he's like, oh, hey, guys. And they're basically like, yo, what the fuck are you doing here? We just busted these cars. I thought it was you, but I wasn't sure. And, you know, obviously Memphis is really cagey. And he's like, hey, you know, I'm just here for like a family emergency. And they're like, okay, well, we're watching you. Basically, like, we see each other. Like, we're out here. Like, we're watching you. I thought that was good. One good quote there is Memphis goes, well, without disappointment, you can't celebrate victory. So I thought that was really good. So then this is when like Memphis now has to call the old crew. So now he knows that the cops know he's back in town. So it's kind of like, the heat is on. Like, what am I going to fucking do? I do love when he calls the old crew and he tries to find out like where everyone is. Like, two people died. Another two are in jail because they probably got busted and they might have still been working after. And then the last two people are Sphinx, who's Vinnie Jones, who's like a mortician. And he's mute and he doesn't say anything. So he pulls him in and then he talks to Sway. My second favorite scene is Sway's intro. So the first time we see her, Memphis goes to like the Ferrari repair place and he sees her there. And then she's like, I got to go back to work. And he's like, you're at work. And she's like, I have two jobs. You have to work like twice as hard when it's honest. And you see her as this bartender. And that's when he tells her like, yo, I need you to help me. And she's like, what? I don't do that anymore. I've cleaned up. Like, I've worked really hard. And he's like, okay, I understand. Like, I get it. Like, I'm not going to make you do this. And you know, you look like you're doing really well. So there's some kind of weird tension between them. Like, I think he left town and she was kind of hoping that he would leave with her or she would leave with him. But he was like, so you know that there's like something weird going on, but it hasn't happened. Like, we don't really know what it was. Like, they probably hooked up a long time ago, and maybe they were in the life together, which I think probably got them caught up in like the excitement of stealing cars. Because come on, like the energy and the adrenaline rush of stealing a car is probably second to none. Like, it's just the fact that it's something that you're not supposed to take, but also like the motion of driving away in it is just probably this thrill. I mean, I don't have a thrill for it like that, but especially what they're doing. I mean, when they're stealing like top end cars and these things they're not robbing from poor people to like just for fun. You know, they're not like carjacking people. Like, they're stealing these like classic cars that someone's going to sell and strip, and these are probably covered by insurance. It's just basically like a loss and it's just really fucked up. But yeah, which, so they never, as I mentioned before, they don't like really tap into the morality issue with it, but it's just, you know, it's whatever. So her intro and her like proposition and the fact that she's a Ferrari specialist, and he's like, oh, okay. Like, she's like, oh, you need me because you have some Italians. And he's like, yeah, I do. And she's like, sorry, you know, I can't. So she says no. So in the midst of all this, he still has to shop for these cars. So you find out that he has like contacts. He gets Donnie Astricki, who's really good. It's like Chi McBride. I feel like he's in one of those like Hawaii Five-0 shows, one of those like CBS shows, and he works at the DMV, so he like can cross-reference the registrations and find out where most of these cars are, which is pretty cool. And then that's when they shop them. Like, they go and scout them, and they see where everyone is. They give them all names. They give them women's names. And yeah, you just see this really cool montage of them shopping around and finding all these cars. My next favorite scene is when you see Memphis at the Ferrari dealership, and he's, like, pretending that he's shopping for a car, and it's, like, peak Nick Cage. Like, this guy comes up to him and is like, "Hi, I'm Roger." And he's like, "That's what a coincidence. My name's Roger. Two Rogers don't make a right, am I right?" And he's just like laughing, like he's just peak Nick Cage. And that's when he tells him, like, you know, "Yeah, I've seen these cars around in front of my local Starbucks. And this is crazy. Like, there's just too many people in this city with too many bloody money." And he's like, "I want to drive." And he like lists off this classic car. And he's like, and the guy's like, "Well, I mean, you wouldn't be seen as like a douchebag, you'd be seen as like a connoisseur." He's like, "I don't have that, but I have something. I might have that in the warehouse." And Memphis is like, "That's great. What else do you have in the warehouse?" And then you kind of like find out that they're gonna like boost from this warehouse, which is pretty cool. We get this like side character who's kind of like the street villain, because he's kind of operating on like the more like rudimentary level, in that he's like has his own crew, and this other guy usually steals cars for Kalitri. This other guy is Master fucking P, like No Limit Records Master P, which I thought was great, because there's always like a rapper in one of these films. Like Ja Rule was in Fast and Furious, so it's like you always have these like rapper cameos, but I think he did really well. So he's kind of like this adversary that's like there but not there. The way that they handle him by sticking the fucking like the truck rig into the axle of his Benz that just pulls the axle completely out from under when they get into like the scuffle later is fucking gold. And then of course the cops like run up to them and see them all with guns, and that's how he like takes care of them and gets them out of his hair. Because the one interesting thing about this is that, so anyway, Memphis is trying to pull the team together, right? Half of them are like dead in jail, out of the life. Kip and his friends who were in on this job, his own crew, they end up having to join in with Memphis and like the old crew, because they're not going to be able to do this. And they figure out that they have to do this all in one night. And Kip is like, "What the fuck? Like, no, we got to spread it out. We're never going to do it." And they're like, no. "You guys are old bucks. You guys are new bucks. You don't know what's going on. And you got fucking caught last time. So shut the fuck up and listen to me and all of our friends, because we have never gotten caught and we know how to do this. So just sit back." So they're like, "Okay, fine." He's like, "Do you want to die? I mean, like, what's going on? This guy's going to fucking kill you. So you better listen up." So they figure out all of it is going to be on one night. They scout the cars. They've got like everything together. So that's when we get the famous like lowrider scene. Everyone knows what they're going to do. All these like snafus happen. When they steal the Ferraris with Sway, it's so fucking cool. She just knows how to start every single car. And all of them are driving. We get a really great scene that I think is not featured in the original length, which is like Memphis and Kip when they're stealing the Ferraris. And Memphis is like, "How are you doing, Kip? Are you all right? Are you nervous?" And he's like, "No, I'm not nervous." And he's like, "Why not? You should be. We're doing all this for you." Like, he kind of snaps at him, but in a very like brotherly way. But it looked like it was very ad lib and really real. And it just really helped along with the story, which I don't remember seeing in the original one. So we also get like the snag in this plan where we find out that these three Benzes that they got this dealer to give them the keys for are now surveillanced by Castlebeck, like this detective. So they're like hot on the trail. So they're like, "Fuck, we got to turn around." They end up stealing the cars from the impound lot that they impounded in the beginning from the police impound. So they do a lot of like kind of nonsensical things that would never actually happen, but it's just great. We get this amazing sexual tension scene between Memphis and Sway when, like I said before, they're waiting to steal that Ferrari. You get a little bit more of the back history of them. And then, you know, they kind of end up together in the end. They're kind of like the ideal relationship. It's kind of like sickening, but it's kind of goals. I don't know. We get that amazing scene where Sphinx is like pushing that car down the ramp with that snake in the car, which I thought was good. Now, the last like probably 30 minutes of the film is the end, is Memphis and Eleanor. So Eleanor is like the 50th car. And this is always his white whale, the hardest to find, the hardest to steal. Something always comes in that messes up the works. And this is when we get this long, like, this is one of my favorite car chases. I know it's kind of cheesy, but it's just got Nicolas Cage looking like he's having so much fun. He's doing so much of the driving. They end up getting chased down into the LA River, which is that concrete bit in Grease, the movie Grease, you know, at the end where they do that car, that race. Another film we have to do because I love Grease. I don't know what happened. I must have been like a 10 or 11 and my mom had Grease on a VHS tape and I just put it in one day and I was just obsessed. I don't even know what happened, but I just love that fucking musical. Like, I thought it was so cool. Like the John Travolta one. I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Like, I just loved watching it and watched it over and over again. So that's what it reminds me of. It's when they get chased to the LA River. And then I wrote, this whole thing is so Bruckheimer. Like the whole entire chase, the way that that is set up, the way that the cops are after him, the way that they go into the shipyard and they get kind of like thrown in and out of these like things exploding. And then like a demolition ball, like comes out of nowhere, like swings, like it's all just like so much, but it just makes for, it's like watching Mission Impossible now. We're just like, oh my God, oh my God. Even John Wick. Like, it's like those kind of action producers really like up the ante for what we expect in action films now. Like, not explosions for the sake of explosions, but they were like the new gen of, like, you know, when we had like the diehards of the 80s and we had these kind of crazy big budget things, but they were like still keeping that fun aspect and not making it too cerebral. Like Christopher Nolan is very like cerebral action director. Like, he's good, but it's always got like this larger picture. This is just like, we're gonna do a car chase and we're gonna have fun. Like, this summer movie, we're gonna have fun, we want to make lots of money. So it's basically like, you're here for the fun, you're here for the cars, you're here for the speed, you're here for Nick Cage. You want him. This is why I love Nick Cage so much, because he is Nick Cage in everything, and then yet he's not at the same time. Like, yet he can disappear into a role, but he's always Nick Cage. He's a verb. He just has something about him that makes him so electric. Like, I saw Renfield in the theater. It was objectively a horrible movie, but it was great because it was Nick Cage being Nick Cage. And like, same with The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent with him and Pedro Pascal. It was like he was playing himself because he is that good and people just love him for that. So he's one of a kind. He really is. And I love that he still does shit and he does kind of weird shit still. And I just love that he's kind of always down. He just sounds really, really fun as far as like his roles and everything. So we get like this the infamous CGI jump on the bridge, which is completely insane, which would never happen. That car would be in shreds. I doubt the suspension could even manage half of the drop that he makes. I mean, the weight of that car, even, could it even go over like a paramedic ambulance and like a car accident and stay within those two lanes on that bridge and safely land enough to drive it all the way like several miles? But then when he does get on the other side of the bridge, like, he knocks off the mirror, like the side mirror. And when he goes to bring it to Raymond Caligiuri, he's like, I said 50 cars, not 49 and a half. Like, and he's like, well, it's okay, just a little paint. He's like, all right, that's fine. Just take it away. Like, fine. We get the final Memphis and Caligiuri battle, which is pretty crazy because Caligiuri's such a fucking bitch. He just runs away as soon as Nick Cage like tries to break his furniture that he makes, and he acts like a baby about it. And he's like, oh my God, you're breaking my chair that I made. But Nick Cage and him get in this like crazy battle. Caligiuri's like shooting at him. And then we get kind of like the action-y, like The Rock. Not The Rock. What's that movie? Con Air? When they're on the plane, like the prisoners. We get like this action kind of sequence from Nick Cage there. And then Castlebeck, the detective, like comes in the nick of time. But then Caligiuri is faced with Castlebeck and he's like seconds away from shooting him. And then Nick Cage comes in and Memphis comes in the nick of time and like kind of high kicks him, like karate kicks him, and then knocks him over this like steel, very much like Terminator 2. Like, you know, in that steel kind of mill or whatever it is, like metal mill or whatever. And like, you know, he falls to his death on top of this coffin that Caligiuri was building. So it's like a very poetic ending. After the job, we find out that he doesn't get in trouble because he saved the cop's life. So he figures out a way to like get him you know, get him off of that. And then we, at the end, we get this amazing scene where all of them are like at Otto's shop. And then we see that Angelina Jolie is there, and her and Memphis are like kind of together now a little bit. Like, it's kind of loose, but it's together. And then Kip at the end gifts Memphis Eleanor, like the car. And then Otto, Robert Duvall, is like, yeah, like, we got this car for you, but I'm going to fix it up. Cause he's like a detailer. And he's like, I'm going to fix it up. It's going to be like a streamlined butterfly. Like, it's going to be so cool. And he's like, oh man. He's like so excited. And, you know, Kip is like, this is just to thank you for everything you did for me. And then at the end, he picks up Sway. He's like, you want to go for a ride? And she's like, hell yeah. And then that's when they drive off, and it has like this great ending. We have also like Vinnie Jones, who was a mute in the whole film, like at the very end, like has this really profound moment. I wish I got more Timothy Oliphant. I wish I got more James Duval in like a driving capacity. He had some comedic moments, but it was worth it for them to be in this kind of well-rounded cast. I love this film. I think that you should see it. It's a really great weekend, or just like want to chill out, have a fun night, you know, toke a little, drink a little, whatever, and just, you know, watch this really fun summer movie of 2000. And yeah, I'm glad that's all I really have. I'm glad for you guys to join me on this journey. I hope you like this solo episode. I guess I can fill out a full one. There are a lot of films that mean a lot to me that, you know, some people don't really like as much or don't have that much to say. So yeah, I guess I'll be doing some more solos. I'm gonna do a fashion episode. I just kind of have to be in the mood, but you know, I'm gonna get more in the swing of things. I was just kind of feeling off, didn't really want to talk, I guess, that much. But me and Charles are recording Havoc this weekend. Get ready. Go watch it on Tubi. Get excited, because it's a fucking mess. And I can't wait to talk about it. And I can't wait to hear everyone's thoughts about it. And I can't wait to clip episodes or like scenes from the movie and put it in the episode and put it on social media, just to get people talking again, especially on TikTok. Like, it'll be really funny, because that movie is wild. Like, it never should have been made, but we're so glad it was, so we can talk about how bad it was. But yeah, I mean, leave a review, comment, whatever. Let me know what's going on, what you want to see, what you don't want to see. Join me on Patreon, and I'll see you on the next one.